Well, this is Steve Maxwell here, editor of Pro Painter magazine, and I'm having a conversation with Brandon Lewis. He's the founder of the Academy for Professional Painting Contractors. We're talking about some questions, talking shop here, and I just thought you might like to eavesdrop on our conversation, so that's what we'll do right now. And welcome, Brandon. Thanks for joining me.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Bud. Excited to get through some of these topics about hiring painters. I know it's the bane of many owners' existence. And then, you know, how do you keep the good ones and a few other things that we have in store.
Okay, perfect. Well, what do you figure the best way is to staff a painting company with the reliable and profitable painters that an owner would need?
Well, I would say the first thing is you have to get your mind right about recruitment. And recruitment is really a marketing function. Hiring is a sales function. We typically don't think about that, but we're going after a certain market of people to generate a list of prospective employees, and then we're trying to sell them on the merits of coming to work for us while we also evaluate whether or not they're a good fit for us. And if you want to get right at the heart of the matter, Steve, the first thing I always ask people, well, I know you say that it's impossible to find good painters. Tell me about how much time and money you have spent over the last 30 days trying to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And typically the answer I get is, well, I've asked my guys if they know of anybody, and I posted an ad on Craigslist. And so okay, you've spent about $20 in about 3 minutes in the last 30 days to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. I said, what if you spend $30 and 3 minutes on your last painting project? How much would you have gotten done? Not much.
Right.
And so the first thing I always ask people, you know, you're probably spending a lot of time trying to generate demand for your painting business, but very few people spend any time trying to generate capacity. And if your demand's off kilter from your capacity, it doesn't work out. And so there are really four little points I just want to share quickly. One is, you need to think of yourself as like a recruiter, maybe a military recruiter or a staffing recruiter and publisher of a magazine, which you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really want to build the biggest list of professionally employed painters in your area, regardless of whether you want to hire them. I mean, you want to have a huge database of people that you can evaluate. Most people start out the process with two or three painters, and that's it, if they ever get to two or three, and then they hire out of desperation. Instead, they think of themselves as the great and powerful Oz, and that everybody else is just lucky that they're offering them a job. And that's not what it takes to get the best talent. So the first part is the market. Who are you going after? Well, most painters are professionally employed and working. And instead, we spend all of our time in online job boards where, you know, people are unemployed. Well, occasionally decent people cycle through the unemployed ranks, but more often than not, they're working for another company. So one thing you have to keep on the table is that you have to be willing to recruit people away from other painters. And they go, well, Brandon, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And I say, well, you're already recruiting, you know, their customers away. And mm-hmm. so if you really have an issue with it, then I would never bid on another painting project if you want your
right.
conscience to be clean. And then market, which market are you going to go after? The message. A lot of people say things like, we're hiring. Come grow with us, experienced painters wanted, which is terrible, especially for people who already have a job. But headlines instead, like for painters whose bosses don't appreciate them, which is where a lot of painters would probably identify. Most people don't quit their companies, they quit their bosses. And when you write good, strong copy like that and you follow it up with the problems that most painters experience, agitate those problems and solve them by letting them know that you're different, it works. And then finally, you have to throw a lot of different mediums at this. Once you get good messaging in place and once you go after the market, you've got to make sure that you're online, that you have signage leading in and out of paint stores, signage in the paint stores, referral programs for the paint stores where people are. You've got to put places up all over town or put messages up all over town, both online and offline, and you have to be willing to engage with painters personally everywhere you meet them in order to get their phone number and their name. This makes a lot of other people uncomfortable, and sit down with them and have a conversation about their career. And if you do this, Steve, really aggressively for about a week or two,
mm-hmm.
really aggressively, you can build a list of 10 to 20 names. And if you will do that and consistently restock all of your marketing systems for recruiting painters, you won't have an issue with finding good qualified painters, but very few people ever put any kind of effort that's comprehensive together for recruitment.
Well, you know, now that you describe it this way, I don't think I've ever seen a painting company owner do this, and yet it seems so obvious. I mean, you stock up with brushes and rollers and drop cloths, and
yep.
you're constantly stocking up on things. But who stocks up on painters? I mean, I've never seen it before.
No, it's rare. Other industries do it. I mean, you'd think, oh well, this is something that only white collar businesses do. Well, drive down the road, Steve. On the back of every 18-wheeler, what do you see?
Yeah, that's right. It's a recruitment message, isn't it?
They cover the whole thing with recruitment messages. I mean, there's as much recruitment marketing on an 18-wheeler as there is recruitment of customers. But for some reason, in our industry, we teach our guys also to put, for painters who want a better career, please call our 24-hour recorded hotline on the back of their vans. It makes no sense to have 100% of your marketing, you know, just for capacity, or just for demand, rather, but zero for capacity. That's how you get out of kilter.
Right. Well, you know, I've picked up on something here that I think is worth emphasizing. You're not just talking about filling all the slots that you have in a company for painters that you can keep employed, but it seems to me you're also... You want people in the batter's box. I mean, people that you know and have a relationship with, but don't necessarily have on the payroll just yet. Is that right?
Well, you're right. And when we get further on in this interview, we're going to talk about, you know, you asked me to think about some of the mistakes people make. And as alien as this whole concept of recruitment is, marketing to the professional painter market, building a list with messages that identify with currently employed painters through lots of mediums all year round. While that is an alien concept, keeping a list of prospects warm is an alien concept to most people as well. It's really not. I mean, it's just the painting industry. But we'll get into that as we go, because that's one of the big mistakes people make.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, one of the challenges I hear from painters has to do with the whole idea of training. So, what are your feelings on how a painting company owner should handle the issue of training painters? I mean, I'm not just necessarily talking about people who don't know how to paint at all, but even experienced painters are going to need training from time to time to meet safety regulations and maybe learn to use new kinds of products, especially if you're in the commercial realm. What's your thought on the whole overall issue of training, and is there a place in a painting business for, you know, regularly taking in people who don't necessarily know how to paint, or maybe not paint proficiently yet, but express a willingness to learn?
Well, I will kind of give you an example in a microcosm that I think we could apply largely, and I will often tell people, on the technical aspects of painting, I'm not enthusiastic or qualified. However, on the process of training, I'm very enthusiastic and qualified. I started my painting business, built it up to over about 20 people and $1 million in sales. I sold it for $440,000. I started it in the recession in 2008, sold it in 2013 before launching the Painters Academy. And, of course, I spent my entire career in marketing and sales and politics. I just happened to run a painting business for one short period of my life. And safety was something that we always trained our guys on, and safety changes all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever you have a process that is going – where everyone has to know something, and when everyone has to be reminded of something, because all training goes through extinction at some point, you know, like the basics, just simple of safety training is, number one, you've got to have a manual. I dare say most people listening to this call, 80-some percent of them, don't have a manual that they distribute to their painters so that they could keep them in the car. And there's all kinds of reasons to do this, not only so that they are safer, but so that you protect yourself against frivolous lawsuits, overzealous governmental agencies, all kinds of things. You need to have some kind of little orientation video. If you've taught your guys the same thing over and over and over and over again, goodness, why do it 40 times from scratch? Just record it one time, and you'll probably do it better. And there are free, so again, going back to safety, there are free training resources. If you rent a lift from a lift company, you can trot 20 of your guys out there, and they will give all of them lift safety training cards. And also, you can usually approach your painting vendors, and they have ladder representatives, which is where our probably biggest risk in the painting industry is in falls. And they'll come out and do a free ladder certification for all of your guys. You put that in everybody's company file. And then toolbox talks. You know, once you've got your hymn book, so to speak, your manual, your orientation video, they've been through some simple training. You need to be having a weekly company meeting. I mean, I don't see how people run their business without it. They think they're taking a shortcut by not spending an hour with their guys or 30 minutes. They're really just taking a long cut. It is terrible practice. And at the end of every meeting, you pick a page of the safety manual, you read it, you talk about it, you ask questions, everybody signs off on a group documentation that they've been through this, and after you've done 52 of these, if there's ever an incident, if anything ever happens, it's all documented from their orientation sign-off sheet to the manual that's in their car that they have read, to the video they went through, to the free resources you put them through, and then maybe some paid resources with like local home building associations or industry organizations. Mm-hmm. And then you continually and constantly do that. And, yeah, it might take you half of a Saturday to set all this stuff up. But, man, once you get it in place, it just becomes second nature and it protects you. So going back to anything, if you're going to train somebody on something, it needs to be written. It needs to be one-to-many and reproducible. If at all possible, you need to look for free and paid resources. And then it needs to be reinforced consistently, and it needs to be documented. If it's not documented, rarely does it take. And then the last thing with things like safety is you also have to have disciplinary action. If people aren't doing what they're supposed to out in the field, and we'll talk about, you know, really the profitability side later, but just sticking with this safety example, if they're caught doing something that's putting them at risk and the company at risk, you've got to stop them, talk to them about it, document it, write it down, and have a personal meeting about it so they feel like it's official and it's not just the boss's casual remarks one Friday morning soon to be forgotten. The more formal it is, the more likely it is to change their behavior.
Right, right. Well, it makes a lot of sense, especially that whole the whole practice of not reinventing the wheel all the time. Build your system and then work the system.
Exactly. I mean, that's the problem. Everybody stops what they're doing, which is typically making money, to constantly handle the exact same problem they handled 3 weeks ago, and they do that about 15 times a year, but there's about 15 of those types of problems. And
right.
So their business life is just one continual disorganized and ill-prepared catastrophe, and somehow there's supposed to be some money left at the end of the year. So it's just tough if you do it that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, it's one thing to have to find good painters, and it's another thing to build your system so that safety is taught and monitored and documented and there's disciplinary measures. But a big part of all this would be retaining the reliable, profitable painters that you've found and trained and groomed and who've come to know your system. What ideas can you offer in the whole realm of retaining the good people that you've worked so hard to get?
So you have to build, Steve, a culture around performance, and you have to reward it. So many owners kind of just have a casual conversation with somebody on the back of a tailgate and then, well, show up and meet me at Mrs. Johnson's house. We'll see how you do. We don't ever tell them what they're supposed to do. We don't ever write it down. We don't ever measure it. We expect them to be the quality of an owner. Well, if they were the quality of an owner, they would be owning a painting business. They wouldn't be working for us in most cases. Right. And so you've got to have clear written goals and processes, and you have to have paperwork and procedures and tools that sustain whatever it is you want them to do. Because people who are really good at performing, that are worth retaining, lack structure, and they lack clear directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think once you provide that structure and clear direction, a lot of it sounds crazy, but a lot of people just want to work in a very comfortable and reliable and non-changing environment where the expectations are clear and the tools are provided. And most people think that's like the bottom of the barrel. Well, it is in most industries, but for us it puts you in the middle of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you've got all that basic stuff that most people leave out of their businesses in place, you need to give folks monetary incentives for making you money. If they save labor hours on a project, which means you have to actually estimate based on labor hours, a lot of people don't, and don't use production rates, but let's say that you do, giving people 50%, 20%, 30% of all the saved labor on a project motivates them to get it done. As long as you tie in customer satisfaction surveys and a dual-column checklist so that the quality control is there and they collect the check, which forces the customer to, you know, basically look at everything and make sure it's correct, you can reward people for coming in on budget on each and every project. You need to do personal recognition from the boss. Not everybody is motivated by money. And it took me a long time to realize this. I got in the habit on at least a monthly basis of putting a handwritten note on each and every paycheck, talking about something good they'd done or I just appreciated them being around. And I'd find those notes in cars. I would find them in people's houses. I would find them all over the place, tacked up on refrigerators of painters' homes. People don't get a kind word, and they especially don't get it in writing.
Mm-hmm.
So we put that in writing, it makes a big difference. In addition to that personal recognition, you need corporate recognition in front of their peers at company meetings. You need to have an agenda for your company meeting that typically includes whatever your mission statement or guiding principles are, almost recited like a Boy Scout oath. I don't know if they recite oaths anymore. I don't know if they believe. I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. Probably don't do that anymore. But an organization that would recite an oath and believe it and stick with it. Think about the Pledge of Allegiance or anything at the beginning of the meeting, and then you go through each and every one of the projects that you've been through, where it came in on budget, and how the customer ranked their experience. And when people do well, you reward them, and you give them their monetary rewards right there in front of everybody, and you say great things. When projects go over budget, that's got to be discussed too, and bonuses can't be paid out. And teams get really used to doing that. I also believe in monthly contests. Some people are motivated by being number one, and you may only have one or two crew leaders in your whole organization or one or two painters that are like that, but they will fight each other to be at number one so often that they will save you tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just for the trophy, just for the picture of who won in the month of June and saved the most labor. And then there's also people that come in second and third, and there's some people that could care less about it. Quarterly bonding events. I mean, show up, you know, once a quarter and cook out for everybody. Go to a park and invite everybody's families. You know, do whatever, rent out a little tiny water park or a museum or something, or buy a little box at a cheap baseball game for all the families to come and feed them. That kind of stuff's important. And then finally, I mean, you have to have disciplinary action for non-performance because performers don't like to work around non-performers, and they don't like pulling their weight forever.
Right.
And that needs to be public, and by that, I mean when budgets aren't met, hey, Steve, we just did the Johnson job here. It was 10 hours over budget. Man, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Bob, Earl, you work with Steve. He just said it was this. Is this what you think it is? Guys, these are pretty simple jobs. We've got to make sure that this happens. And then privately, if something is consistent, you've got to take them aside and fill out the disciplinary report and the paperwork. And then finally, it sounds crazy to think that retaining people could be related to firing people. But when you fire someone who is not pulling their weight or who is disrespecting other people or has done something unethical. In your company meetings, you need to say, guys, you may notice that John's not here today. Well, here's why. We've only got three rules here: that will make the customer happy, that will come in on budget, that will follow the company rule book, and that we will not lie, cheat, or steal the company or each other. And somebody was caught not doing one of these, and we just can't have people in our culture like this because y'all are following the rules. So that's one good way. All those things together help retain profitable painters, and you put profitable in there. People think there's just a one-size-fits-all for this, and anytime you talk to somebody who's really good at something, they never tell you the one thing they did to get there. They've always got, how long do you have? It takes a lot to get to where you want to get, just like you. I mean, I know that you've got an amazing enthusiasm for living independently and for being out in the great outdoors, and you've got a vast store of knowledge. I mean, if somebody asked you how to do any one thing, you could probably talk for 20 minutes about it because you're good at it. Well, if owners have to realize that if you want to be good at something, you've got to become a serious student of it, and you've got to figure out not just the one way to get there, but the 10 ways that really get you where you want to get.
Yeah, life's not simple, not as simple as a one-stop to success. You're absolutely right. It's a layered approach.
Very much so.
I'd like to learn more, as specific as you can get, about the best ways to measure the profitability of individual painters you hire. Because, as you said, I mean, no business owner hires someone, out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, not if they're looking to make some sort of a profit. They're providing work for people so that they can support themselves and their families. But, of course, the owner needs some measure of minimum productivity in order for them to make money. So technically, what's the best way to measure the productivity and profitability of the painters that you've got in your employ?
So I think, again, a lot of this always goes back to someone's preconceived notion that is incorrect, and fixing that goes a long way. If somebody was in the business of buying candy wholesale and then selling it retail, they would know the cost of everything they bought. Meaning if they bought a pack of gum for 10 cents and they sold it for 20 cents, they would know what the fair rate was for those materials, especially if they sold something that was uniform. Hey, you bought bowling balls wholesale and you sold them retail somewhere. Everybody in their right mind would understand it's really important to keep track of that stuff and to know what I'm paying and what I'm getting. People in the painting business are very confused about the fact that they are buying labor wholesale and that they are selling it retail.
Right.
You are a buyer and seller of labor hours. But when you look at how people estimate, not sell, okay, not how you persuade people or sell. That's a whole other item. Estimating is a lot easier than being persuasive. Most people leave all the persuasiveness out of their sales process. They email it in like it's a pair of shoes off Amazon, even though it's $6,000 to $10,000, in league with what a cosmetic surgeon or an attorney or a doctor would sell, and their closing rates are terrible, and they get beat by low-priced competitors, and they can't figure out why. Well, they should really ask themselves, how do I even get a job occasionally? Should be the miraculous thing they come to. Well, same thing here. When you estimate, if you're buying and selling labor hours, you need to know what a labor hour can do, how far it goes, and what you paid for it and what you have to charge for it. And typically that means you've got to be using production rates. And if you get into even your own Facebook page, where people start talking about production rates, they get confused. They think that production rates are what you charge the customer. No, that's pricing. Production rate is how long does it take your painter to paint any given surface. So a production rate might be 100 square feet of wall brushed and cut in an hour, or 15 linear feet of trim. Or whatever it is, or 45 minutes per door whatever those things are. It's usually number of, square footage of, and linear feet of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once you get clear on that, and you go out and you estimate, not based on a guess, and you can't guess. I've tested owners over and over again. They can't guess. You put them in the same room that's shaped different with the same surface area. They give you two different guesses. They come back to it the second day. It's a different guess than it was the first day. People can't guess. A man can't even take a 10-foot board into his backyard and cut it exactly 6 feet without a measuring tape. But he thinks he can estimate a whole house because he's smart. It makes no sense. It's illogical. And so the first thing is you got to know how long does it take in labor hours, and then you've got to communicate how many labor hours there are in any given project to your own, to your painters. Most people don't do that, Steve. They don't even tell them, hey, you got 118 labor hours. They just set them on the job and hope everything comes out all right. And then they're mad at the painters when they don't communicate even when they're supposed to be finished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's crazy. But it's the lack of communication, written especially, with people. And then on every project, it's very simple. How you know if they're productive or not? If you got good established field-tested production rates, then you just measure how many hours did they use. If they came in under budget, they're really productive. If they come in over budget, they're not productive, at least not as productive as you'd like. Now, sometimes you have to look at three or four projects in a sequence, and you do the same thing with materials to make sure people aren't robbing you blind.
Right.
And you just do a post-mortem report. It's simple. I mean, it's like 7 or 8 little numbers that go into an Excel sheet. You could even do it manually on a piece of paper. You don't have to get real technical. And so you have bought from Jimmy 40 labor hours. You hoped that he would be able to paint 40 labor hours worth of things on a job. Well, basically you sold 40 of Jimmy's labor hours to Mrs. Johnson, but you actually paid Jimmy for 50 of them. Well, that's not good.
No.
So the easy way is, number one, understand the currency in which you trade. Number two, estimate that way. Number three, report it to the guys and let them track it on a daily basis, and you check in on it and emphasize it. And then third, monitor it as quickly as you can and as soon as the job is done so that we can go back to that whole segment of questions previously, which is how do you retain and motivate profitable painters? All the things we had mentioned with the monetary compensation, personal recognition, contest, corporate recognition, bonding, disciplinary action, etc. So the question is, people ask like it's a mystery. Well, how do you know if they're profitable? Well, you measure it. It's real simple. It's like, how do you know what your gas mileage is with your car? Well, you put some gas in it. When it runs out, like, that's how far it goes, and you kind of know how far the car goes. And so that's really it. You measure it once, you document it, report it, incentivize it, and there should be no question. Every owner who is in business should be able to know who is profitable and who isn't. And if they're not tracking it, they deserve whatever financial catastrophe comes their way.
Sure. Can you point to some industry numbers, documents or reference manuals or anything like that, that outlines, and of course this is in a general term, but outlines the kind of productivity that painters should be achieving? Or does it all
have to be? All over the place. Of course, the PDCA publishes something. I got my hands on it a long time ago, and I think it's good, and it's a good starting point. It seemed to be geared at the time. Now, it's been a while since I revisited this. Toward commercial, kind of wide open, empty areas. Residential's a little bit slower. You got to move stuff. More important for you not to mess anything up than for you to get done real fast. And people are willing to pay a premium, especially if your sales process supports premium pricing, along with your percentage of repeat and referral business being up in the 50s and 60s, although most people are only around the 10 or the 15s. But so that's number one. Number two, I just recommend, so that people feel really confident in their productivity numbers, all you have to do is measure it. You take a little production diary with you, a Word document. I mean, you could do it with a piece of legal paper, and it has what you're painting, how many square feet of it you're painting, when you started and when you stopped, or how many linear feet or how many number of, and you just paint it at not a breakneck pace and not a slow pace, and you just see how long it takes you. And after you get about 3 data points, you've got a pretty good guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard. I mean, people, it kills me. I've watched these forums and chat rooms, and it makes me want to pull my hair out. How much would you charge to paint this? And they show a picture of a house. I'm like, good God. I mean, one time in your life, why don't you just figure out how long it takes you to paint something, figure out what you pay somebody, figure out what you charge them, and then you would not be in the dark for 30 years. But instead, people are so lazy, they won't take 2 weeks of their life to be in the know for eternity. And
that's quite
so,
surprising, you know, and really quite simple.
It's easy. I mean, it's just you basically said, okay, well, we're in a bedroom here. It's 10 by 10, and it's 8-foot ceilings, so that means there's 80 square feet of it per wall. We've got 4 of them, so that's 360 square feet. It's 130. I'm going to write that down on my calendar here along with the square footage, and I'm just going to start painting, and then I'm going to put my stop time in, then I'm going to go to the next room. I'm going to do the same thing, and then the third room. And I'll come back and do the trim, and I'll measure that too. And then, I mean, you are done. Okay, let's paint 5 doors. How long did it take me? This is what I charge.
Mm-hmm.
Easy. Blows my mind. I mean, it's like, I bet a good 10% of all painting-related chat rooms are people showing pictures of things and asking how much they should charge. And it's just insane.
Mm. Interesting. Well, Brendan, I just have one more question for you, and tell us about the 1 or 2 or 3 things you wish you had known when you started your painting business, if we haven't covered them now. I'm sure some of what we've talked about would fit into that category, but is there anything that you wish you had known that you know now?
There's some things I knew, but I did not know to the extent that I know them. The first one is the remarkable and amazing purchasing power of your past customer list. Most people, and the reason I know it is because I didn't even grasp it as thoroughly as I did when I got out. I came from a nonprofit and a fundraising background, so we didn't even have a tangible service to sell. You gave us big piles of money. We made you feel a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. A feeling. We sold a feeling. And so the way we communicated consistently with that list of donors made all the difference in the world. Most people do not realize that they've got organic spending in their customer list of about $1,000 per year, which means if you've got 1,000 clients, you've got a $1 million painting business, and that doesn't even count the referral value if you just capture it. But most owners don't even have their customers in an Excel list. The few that do don't communicate with them. The few that do communicate only send a Christmas card. And we teach our guys to remain in monthly communication through a mailed and emailed newsletter, and to also do 3 reactivation campaigns per year in the early spring, peak of summer, and leading into the winter and the fall. And occasionally we move those around based on the need of the company. If there's a backlog and there's no need, I mean, sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. But people just vastly underestimate how frequently they purchase and how often they purchase. And if you don't keep and retain your clients, and most painters don't, you get the privilege of starting over every 3 years after about year 3. Get the privilege of starting over every year after about year 3. And because no one, it'd be like being up in Canada right now. You could have the best heating and the best insulation in the world in your cabin, but if you open the doors and windows, it ain't going to stay warm, is it?
No, absolutely not.
No, so that's what happens. They just open up the front door, let them out the back door. They never contact them, never speak with them again, and then nobody can remember anybody. And that's why there really isn't a dominant player in any given market, is because everyone is just continually and constantly swapping clients.
Mm.
No one retains anybody. And the numbers prove that out after doing 600-plus assessments. That's the cause. So that's number one. And just one other that I would probably point out. There's tons, obviously, but the transformative power of a persuasive sales process. Most people show up if they even answer their phone, and 60% of calls are abandoned in the service industry when it goes to voicemail. And people often ask, you know, what's the number one thing I could do to increase my sales? I said, well, the easiest thing you could do is just get an answering service. They don't want to hear that. They want something fancy like 15,000 ways to close or whatever.
Right.
But get the phone answered, and then we teach our guys to pre-position, to present, to post-position, and follow up with powerful proof, lots of social proof, video testimonials, warranties, guarantees to put messaging together that targets the actual client's worries and fears about having folks in their home or their business that they don't know around the people they love and the things they love, the terrible reputation of our painting industry and how we can leverage that instead of run away from it, follow-up that actually mirrors the buying cycle, you know, the typical major purchase in the United States, at least, by Synchrony and GE Capital is $500. For a major household purchase, takes people 68 days to pull the trigger on it. 40% of people go to the store three times, but the typical painting contractor writes an estimate for that on average $3,000, might call them two times in a two-week period, and they abandon the sale. Well, the follow-up doesn't match the sales cycle. It'd be like pulling up a tomato plant if it didn't have a tomato on it after 2 weeks. That's not how tomato plants work. And so there's just aligning your sales process with the messaging and the proof and the timing of how the client actually buys for it to be a white-collar selling service or white-collar selling service persuasive process similar to what you would experience if you went to the top cosmetic surgeon in your area or if you went to see a high-end divorce attorney or if you went to try to get a realtor to list a million-dollar home, what would that process be look like? Would look like? Because often, when we're charging $7,000 to $10,000 to $15,000 to $20,000, even $3,000 or $4,000, we're charging the same service, or rather, charging the same aggregate price as our white-collar, sophisticated counterparts. But our sales processes do not look anything like theirs, and that's why we constantly lose on price, because the client can't differentiate between an unlicensed and an illegal painter versus a professional one because the process and the proof looks identical. So the two things is just the power both of referral and repeat business out of your customer list. I wish I had done a better job of that, and I wish I had beefed up my sales process like we do now for our members. So those two things alone, typically the typical painting business, if everything else stays the same, Steve, if they will just fix their neglect of their past clients and improve their sales process, they can usually double their income. It's not real hard.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, this has been great, Brandon. I really do appreciate the time you've spent, and just about every word you've said has rung true with some real-world wisdom. So thank you again. This is Steve Maxwell. I'm the editor of Pro Painter Magazine, and I've been speaking with Brandon Lewis, the founder of the Academy for Professional Painting Contractors, and he's been kind enough to share some wisdom with us. So thank you very much, Brandon.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye for now, everyone.